So, welcome to Bible study on this fine April 13th day.
What book are we going to go to?
We are going to be looking at the Haftarah section. Does everyone know what Haftarah is? The section of the prophets that you read on the yearly cycle that's related to the Parashah. And since the Parashah is taken from Leviticus, several portions dealing with, well, one of them dealing with leprosy, the Haftarah is similar. There's two selections. I think we'll only have time to look at one of them. In 2 Kings 4, verses 42 to chapter 5, verse 19. And that's what we'll be looking at. I'll just start us off with some prayer. Lord, thanks for bringing all of us here this morning, and thank you for the rest you give us. And we ask that you would inspire our thoughts today as we read your word, and we want to understand you more. We want to find new things and realize things maybe we've forgotten or need to hear. And so we ask that you be with our discussions and follow throughout this service. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So, it's interesting that, to me it's interesting that the parasha starts before the section on Gehazi. Let me back up a bit. 2 Kings 4, we're dealing roughly with Elisha, which you might call Elisha. My problem when I speak English, Elisha and Elijah sound so similar, it's easy to get messed up. Whereas Eliyahu and Elisha sound completely different. So you can keep them more separate. And so happens his name was Elisha. But who is Elisha, just to get us all on the same page?
He's the follower of, he followed Elijah as the
right?
prophet.
As prophet, yeah. So he is a prophet. Where is he a prophet? Where does he live, roughly?
Somewhere in Israel.
Somewhere in Israel, okay. To be specific, in Israel, which means not in Judah.
In the north.
In the north, right? Because these are the days where the kingdom is divided. So the south is Judah and Benjamin, that's considered Judah. They have a different king. Israel is the northern tribes. Some other places may call it Ephraim. Anyway, they're northerners. So it's an interesting time because being northerners, they're not part of the temple, right? And part of everything else that we've come to associate with worship of God. But these are prophets of God, right? Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Adonai. And so their stories are pretty wild and sometimes unconventional. Anyway, so our parasha was about leprosy, and then it brings up this story because it's going to deal with leprosy. This is basically the story of Naaman, or Naaman, which again, you say in English, you'll get confused. My son, he was drawing a Purim picture of Queen Esther and Naaman, and he had him all bandaged up like a leper.
Oh.
No, that's Haman. Because he's hearing all these stories in English. Haman and Naaman sound alike. Naaman. Who is Naaman?
He's an army officer.
Which army?
Syrian.
Yes, Syrian, or Aram. The land to the north of Israel. And this is in a time when, you know, they've been going back and forth in wars. And if you read through Eliyahu and Elisha's stories, it kind of sounds like Aram is stronger than Israel a lot of the time, although God's always helping out with miracles. So, back to my point, we start before Naaman's actual story, which is kind of curious. We start the Haftarah in verse 42 of chapter 4. And do you all remember this story? It's the first feeding of the 5,000. Although it's only 100. But very interesting. Why doesn't someone just read through it? It's a very short little story. We'll read through it and then we'll ask the question, why does the Haftarah start there? But maybe we won't get to that till later. So, who wants to read it?
Chapter 4, verse 42.
Verse 42, yes.
Then a man came from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley bread, and newly ripened grain in his knapsack. And he said, give it to the people that they may eat. But a servant said, what? Shall I set this before 100 men? He said again, give it to the people that they may eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over. So he set it before them, and they ate, and had some left over, according to the word of the Lord.
All right. So, as Christians, you read this story, and you hear immediately connections to Jesus, right? What are some of the similarities when Jesus feeds the 4,000 or the 5,000?
The disciples don't believe it at first.
The disciples are like, how are you going to do this, right? Jesus uses the same words, give it to the people and let them eat, right? So that kind of sends us back to the story.
The multiplication happens as it's being passed out.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like the actual, they're in doubt, but the actual doing of it is what disproves their doubt. Until they actually do it, they don't realize it can be done, which is kind of powerful to me.
And then there's also some left over.
There's also some left over. And that's a sign. Mm-hmm. That shows, you know, it's like an extra. You didn't think God could supply for 100? Well, guess what? He can supply for 200. You know, it's like that right back at you kind of thing. Little picante. Mm-hmm. God likes to be with his miracles. The difference is, of course, Jesus doesn't say, because thus saith the Lord, and then give what he heard from God. Jesus has more of a direct link. And so it happens as his word is. Another interesting tidbit, interesting to me, I don't know how many of you are interested, but in verse 42, Danny, you read your translation, what is it? About the knapsack? Did you read knapsack?
Knapsack, yes.
Right. Okay. So it says, he brings the bread of the first fruits, which are 20 loaves. Mm-hmm. They're barley loaves. And it says also, Carmel Betziklono. And this was understood as ciclone was the word of some kind of sack, knapsack, bag. And you have a word from that today. But since they've been translating that, they found in Ugarit. Everyone knows where Ugarit is up north? They have the same word, but it's not ciclone with a be, like in. It's betziklon. That's the whole word.
Betziklon.
And it actually is a kind of a head of grain, which is also used as a dry measurement. In the same way, if you look at the book of Ruth, she's collecting the omarim. That's it's referring to stalks of grain, but it can also be referring to an amount of grain, a set dry measurement. So here, it's some kind of also grain dry measurement. So it hasn't mentioned any kind of bag. It's mentioning a kind of grain in a certain measurement. So that's just a random aside, but it's nice to see how the cultures interact. And again, we're dealing with a story from the north, right? And so Ugarit is just up higher in the north, and you would expect that their dialect of north would be, you know, there would be some loan words or some mutual vocabulary going on. So it's nice to get it there. Okay, so we're in 2 Kings in the Haftarah, and we have just looked at verses 42 and 40 to 44.
Of what chapter?
2 Kings. It's where Elisha multiplies the food for prophets. Very small little story. And we just talked about how Ugaritics helped explain this. Oh, by the way, this word Betziklon is only here in the Bible. So, that's just a nice aside. Anyway, then right after this short little story, oh, by the way, who in, we have Jesus and the disciples. Who is it that expresses the doubt in this story?
The servitor.
The servant, the mesharet. This word mesharet. Who is the mesharet of Moses? What? Well, not specifically.
Joshua.
Yeah, Aaron, when he's mentioned, he is, you're right, he functions as a mesharet, but he's never called that. He's more on par with Moses, even though he's somehow under him. But specifically it says of Joshua that he is mesharet Moshe. So...
Excuse me,
yes.
But you've come a long way from South Africa to join your Bible study with me, man.
Okay.
We are very special. Sorry to...
Oh, welcome.
Are there enough chairs there? There are nine of...
You know?
Pull up some chairs.
I've heard that the Bible studies are very special somewhere.
Okay.
They are indeed.
To
interrupt.
Okay.
That if you just read them. Just let me know what you're talking about.
We are talking about the portion from the prophets for this week, the Haftarah, which is 2 Kings, chapter 4, the very end.
Goedemorgen en baie welkom.
Dank u.
And so we've just finished talking about the short story of Elisha and how he multiplies bread and his mesharet, his what I would call an apprentice, has doubt. Does it give his name in this little story?
Mm-mm.
It does not give his name. But we know from other stories, or we'll find out, his name is Gehazi. And I just point that out because mesharet, like Joshua to Moses, he isn't just a little servant. He is the apprentice. He is going to become Moses when Moses retires. So that puts our following story in a different light if you think about Gehazi being the apprentice of Elisha. Okay, so now we get to the main featured story of the Haftarah. And we have more characters introduced. We have Naaman, who we already mentioned, is the army commander of the Syrians, or Aram. And he's not a small ranking commander. He is, as Hebrew so eloquently puts, Ish Gadol. He's a big guy.
An important.
Big yes. Guy. He is a top ranking official before his master. The master is the king. But it does set out in the first verse that all his victories come from God. In the sense that if there is one God and he's in control of everything, then he's allowed this guy to have all these victories. And that's already gives you a clue into this story that the author's trying to show you that God is for the world and not just Israel. Which isn't always an emphasis in some of these stories. We also know that he's what we translate mighty man of valor, Gibor Hail. And our salient, our important piece of information is the last word in verse 1. What is he?
Leper.
Metzora, which we translate leper, some kind of skin disease. And we've talked about it. In fact, last year, Gary gave a Bible study on leprosy. And we talked how leprosy today, we think of Hansen's disease, very specific stuff. It's not necessarily the same thing, but it is a serious skin disease that resulted in uncleanness. Uncleanness that there didn't seem to be a remedy for, in the sense that you were separate from society. And you'd have to go around crying, unclean, unclean. So if you think of diseases that would just be terrible to get, this would be it, because you are considered perpetually unclean. There was also, maybe it was contagious, Although in this story, Naaman, he appears before the king, who isn't afraid of catching it from him. He appears before the king of Israel, and there's no direct contagion. But you could also say it's at a different stage. But whatever it is, it's some skin disease. And what do we know? The descriptions are kind of unclear, but if you read your parasha, what can you say about the way this word, tzara'at, what does it look like? When a person is metzora, when they're inflicted with disease, what do they look like?
They've got long hair and
long hair. Long hair? Not necessarily long hair. You're talking about the hairs that grow out of different things.
Unshaven?
Well, not necessarily. I mean the disease. How does it show up? What are the symptoms that you can see?
It talks about white hairs coming out of a pitza, a wound.
In Leviticus it does mention that. White. White. Somehow your skin looks white. Typically in the Bible when it describes leprosy it says white as
snow.
Right. And so there are some people that Jacob Milgram is a Jewish scholar who's done a lot of research in the law, little itty-bitty-goodies. And one of his main ideas is that the whole system of uncleanness is based on things that are associated with death or have the appearance of death. And one of his claims is leprosy causes such uncleanness because you appear white like death. Like your skin takes on a completely different shade. Interesting little theory. Anyway, so we don't know the disease, but we do know, according to the Bible, the consistent description of leprosy is that it's white as snow. And when people get it, it is a bad fate because there doesn't seem to be a cure. Okay, so why don't we have someone read, I guess we can read verse 1 again, 1 to 7. Or, let's see. Actually, read 1 to 4, verses 1 to 4.
Chapter 5?
Yeah, go ahead.
Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said.
Okay, so we have some little ironic contrast here. Naaman, it says, he stands before the king of Aram. And he's a, what is he we mentioned? A great important man. He's a Ish Gadol.
Mighty man of valor.
A mighty man of valor. And in contrast, we have this Na'ara Ktana. So we have this little maiden. Little Na'ara. Now Na'ara, when it says Na'ara Ktana, it doesn't necessarily mean age. It could also be a rank thing. In the same way that Naaman is so high and important, she's basically a low, very lowly woman. And she, you know, sets out all the rank. She is the maid, not of Naaman himself, but his wife, who is under Naaman, who is under the king. So we have this chain of command, so to speak. But it's her idea that he should go to Shomron. Again, you have this concept of God being the God for Israel and Syria, because that she would think her commander would go to Shomron, to the other side, to get help. And where is Shomron? Or Samaria?
North
of Israel. And what would you describe it as? A small city, big city?
Big.
Big. Very big. Often the capital. So that's where, again, we discussed the two kingdoms. If you're in the north, Shomron is the big city, and you have a king there. And you don't have the official temple, but I'm sure you have other things, as other prophets have mentioned. Okay. So, we'll continue. Verse 5 to 7. Would you like to read over there? I forget your name.
Joy.
Joy.
Mm-hmm. Then the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. Then he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said, "Now be advised when this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy." And it happened when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me."
Okay. So, what's ironic in these verses here? Specifically in the king of Israel's reaction.
He thinks he's the one that's supposed to be doing the healing.
Right? He says, "Am I God that I'm supposed to be able to do this?"
Well, he sees it as a ruse. I mean, it's clearly a vassal relation.
Right.
And so he probably just reads it as this is a pretext.
He's going to pick a fight with me.
Yeah, he's come, you know, this is, he's big,
right.
Yeah.
Which, it's kind of understandable, considering that many times Syria comes in and invades Israel, and takes away valuable resources. But, on the other hand, if that were the ruse, would the king bother sending these caravans of expensive gifts? Maybe not.
Maybe it's a Trojan horse
type. A Trojan horse. Yeah, maybe. The king seems slightly paranoid.
I think that's why the king was to send his presence to show it's not a ruse.
Right.
I'm not trying to pick a fight with you.
It's a serious request.
I want my general to be healed.
Right. However, it does show that leprosy is one of those. It's like if you sent someone to be cured from HIV.
Right.
Like, they'd be like, "Who am I, God? Like, how am I supposed to do this? It can't be done." In other words, God is the only one who can do this kind of thing. And we have that nice lehamit ulehayot.
And it's also kind of like, not, you know, can you see what you can do? It's this, please be advised.
Mm-hmm.
Get this guy healed.
Right. You don't have an option not to. But the main thing he's missing, you contrast him with the little girl, or we'll say the female servant, because who knows if she's a young girl or not. She knows. What does she know?
God can heal.
He doesn't seem to know.
Yeah. And not only does she know that, but she knows how has God healed? What does she refer him to? Oh, there's a prophet in Shomron. So she knows there's a prophet in Shomron. And the king, who lives in Shomron, doesn't seem to realize that there are ways to approach God, and he does things, and he's worked through this guy, this prophet.
It also doesn't occur to the girl to have him go via the king, but to go straight to the prophet.
Right, well, she suggests the prophet, and I guess, you know, the whole chain of command. Prophets, it is interesting how they tend to be near kings, right? They advise kings. So in the south, in Judah, you have Isaiah, you have Micha. A lot of the prophets hung around the court.
In the entire region.
Entire ancient Near East, right.
You would be within the state system. You wouldn't go out.
So,
he's going
exactly.
By protocol, by addressing the king.
Even
first.
The false prophets. You think of Jezebel, the prophets of Baal. You know, they sit and eat at her table. Like, they are state-sponsored prophets. So if you're trying to get to the prophet, the protocol, you go to the king, you know, to use his prophet, kind of, so to speak.
Which demonstrates that there's an adversarial relationship in some sense between the prophet and the king, or at least not a
There may be. there's always that point of tension, because the prophet is supposed to give advice to the king, but the king may or may not want to hear that advice.
But in any case, an enemy can't just come into across the border. You've got to go to the king first.
Right, unless
you...
Yeah.
Even here, when we arrive, we can't come and see you. We have to go to the border.
Crossing the border.
We have to go to immigration.
Sure. So he's doing the right protocol. Again, not picking a fight. He's actually following protocol. His gifts are extensive also. We notice that. As is proportionate to what he's asking. He's asking for a miracle. Okay. So now we have Elisha. He enters the picture. Someone read verse 8 for us.
And it was so when Elisha, the man of God, had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, Wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel.
Okay. So, this is interesting. Two things jump out quickly. He'll know that there is something in Israel. What would you expect to be there?
A good doctor.
As well?
A God.
I was thinking God.
God, yeah.
In
God
other passages, you'll know that there's a God in Israel. Israel. So it's interesting he's actually substituted prophet. Oh, wow, that's chutzpah.
Yeah.
But it's an ironic statement because he is...
the king doesn't seem to know.
He's thanking the king for saying, didn't you realize I'm here? Like, don't you view my job as legitimate? Like... He's going to know there's a prophet because you didn't know, you know. So the idea is actually everybody will know. If he can know, how much more should you have known? Okay. So Naaman goes to his house. And Elisha sends out his servant. Go and dip in the Jordan 7 times and your skin will come back and be purified. Okay, Naaman's response, he gets very angry, and he goes. And he says, look, I thought to myself, he'll definitely come out, and he'll stand there, and he'll call in the name of God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, uses God's personal name, his God. And he'll wave his hand toward the place, and my leprosy or my skin disease will be gathered up, or healed. So Naaman, what's he expecting? A miracle. I'd almost say magic. He's expecting some kind of utterance and some kind of symbolic motion. He's looking to Elisha to do some kind of something. And Elisha seems to know that that's what he's going to expect. And so he... not only doesn't give him what he's going to expect, but he removes himself one step further. He doesn't even show up. He has no direct contact. So there's no way you could claim that this healing was a direct magic act from Elisha. We remember other stories of Elisha where he sends his rod ahead to place on the person. He expects that to heal. So there is this concept that he is so... he's a representative of God as God's prophet, that he's an extension of God in the sense that if he touches you, something's going to happen.
And dipping in the water probably gives you like a very temporary soothing and maybe gets rid of the whiteness while
you're wet. Or maybe just purely ceremonial.
Right.
I mean, we notice it 7 times, right? That's a not just in Israel, but in the ancient Near East, 7 is considered... a holy number and kind of could even be magical in the sense of ceremony. You have things going on 7 times. So, all that to say, Elisha is on purpose distancing himself, his personal contact from Naaman.
And from his magical expectations.
Because he wants to prove, what's Naaman supposed to know after this whole ordeal?
That
there's a God in Israel. Even though it says there's a prophet in Israel. Actually, that there is a God in Israel. And he is God. The implication is not just in Israel, but for everybody. Okay. So, then his servant convinces him. In verse 12. Oh, first he talks about the rivers of Damascus being so much better than Israel. Why can't I dunk in them and be purified? So he goes away angry. But then his servants come and speak to him and convince him that, you know, if this prophet had commanded you a big thing, you would have done it. So why not do this little thing that is essentially just dunking in a river? Basically, it doesn't hurt you. Why don't you just do it? And so he's convinced and he does it. He goes down and he dips in the Jordan, a nice little muddy stream. And he dips 7 times and he's healed. And what does his healing look like?
Skin like a boy.
Na'ar katon, a small child. And he's pure. He's pure now, in contrast to leprosy, that's the ultimate uncleanness. Now he's ceremonially clean. So this prompts him to go back. I'm in verse 15. He goes back to the man of God with all his entourage. And he comes and he stands before him. So this time, Elisha, after the miracle, actually meets him. They have a face-to-face encounter. So here in verse 15, why doesn't someone read that? Here is what comes out of Naaman's mouth.
He and his entire entourage returned to the prophet. Naaman came and stood before him. He said, "For sure I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now please accept a gift from your servant."
Right. So did Elisha achieve his goal? Yeah, because he's made this a
opportunity
to prove that there is God and He is one God and He's in control of everything. It's not just a personal, oh, you have a problem and I'm going to solve it for you and then I'm just going to send you on your way. It's like, no, this is a grand universal proof. And Naaman gets it because of how it was done. He understands this couldn't have just been Elisha and some magic trick. There is a God in Israel. Because there's no way that dunking in the Jordan did anything for healing my leprosy. It's a small little river, if you can call it a river. You know, and no one was there with me. It was just me getting in dunking. You know, so now I know that there is a God. In fact, there's no other God like this. There is no other God besides this God. And He's the God of Israel. So it's this huge declaration of faith.
It's what all tourists should be impressed by coming to Israel. How pitiful and junky this land is.
Yes.
For sure.
So in his response, he wants to give a blessing. I like that. Because today we use the same language. If you go to another church and they want to bless you, what does that mean?
Money.
Money. It means money. Or it means some other benefit. He wants to help you out, to show his gratitude. We want to bless you. He wants to bless. He wants to give a bracha. And so then in verse 16, we have Elisha getting a little strong. He swears in God's name, Hai Adonai, by God, who I stand before, like I'm his servant, which we've already had in the beginning of the story, you know, name is a servant, the little, or the young woman is a servant. By God whom I stand before, you know, I'm not going to take anything. And so Naaman is urging him to take it, and he still refuses. So why does Elisha refuse the blessing?
Because then it will look like the man is paying for the healing.
Yeah. It looks like it's a transaction, it's a favor, maybe it looks too much like a magic act. Yeah, I'm going to pay you because of what you did for me.
Is it because he felt like it wasn't him that was God?
Right. It gives him more credit. Because if I'm giving you some kind of benefit, I'm saying you've done something for me. When Elisha's whole point, he set this whole thing up so that it would point to God. Because he wants a bigger thing than Naaman's healing.
Paul,
Simon the sorcerer wanted to pay Paul for to get the power. Not his own healing, but power. And Peter had some harsh words for him as well. Yeah, so essentially his whole setup has worked wonderfully, but if he did that, in his mind it would be ruining everything. So it was really, the principle was really important to Elisha, don't accept anything. Even though in the past he has accepted, both he and Eliyahu accept things from people because of what they've done or their position. In fact, the story we read, the end of chapter 4, verse 42-44, people were bringing him this bread of first fruits. So you could say he's in the position of prophet slash priest. There's no official temple in biblical eyes. There was, in fact, temples in the north. But he is accepting these gifts, these tithes from people. So he doesn't have an inherent problem with accepting gifts. It's just in this situation, because he's trying to use it to send a certain message, and it has international implications, it's very important to him that the principle stands. So Naaman winds up his first declaration in verse 17, and he says, okay, not only this, he gets it. Naaman gets why Elisha refuses to take the gifts. Because he realizes, oh yeah, it wasn't really you. It was what I just said. It was the God of Israel. And so what's the logical conclusion? I need to thank the God of Israel. Therefore, I need to start serving the God of Israel. And how am I going to do that if I don't live in Israel? Right? So there's this idea everywhere in the ancient Near East that a God is connected to land. So if the God of Israel, you need to be in Israel to serve him. As we have the captives in Babylon, one of their frustrations is, how can we serve God in a foreign land? And even the northern kingdom, when it fell to the Assyrians, they requested land be brought so that they could serve God. Land, like physical dirt, be brought from Israel so that they could serve God. And so he comes with the same conclusion. Let me pack up some land from here and cart it back to Aram so that I can serve God.
It's good that he didn't come to the other conclusion of, well, maybe we just need to conquer that land so that we can be where God is.
Right.
That's right. He took the more humble approach. I don't need to conquer it. I'll just take a little piece back with me. And so he says, from now on, I'm not going to make sacrifices to any other god, only to God. And he uses Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, God's personal name. And he makes one exception in verse 18. He says, please forgive me the one thing. You know, I have to go in with my master, the king, so when he bows down, I'm going to have to bow with him. But, you know, it's not real worship. My heart's not in it. You know, just ignore it, basically, is what he's asking. And so Elisha never actually tells him, yeah, go ahead, take the dirt, or you need to have dirt with you there to worship God. He just says, he sees the intention, and he says, okay, fine, go in peace. And so he goes away. So far, so good. And now we have the problem, or a problem, enter in verse 20. Go ahead and read, someone read 20 and 21. Anyone.
Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, see, my master has spared this man, the Syrian, not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him. So Gehazi followed Naaman. And when Naaman saw someone running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, is all well?
Read another verse. Okay.
And he said, all is well. My master has sent me to say, they've just now come for me from the hill country of Ephraim, two young men of the sons of the prophets. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothing.
Okay. So, what is, like house guests are going to need a great big chunk of silver.
Benny Hinn doesn't pass out the plate himself.
Right.
And two changes of clothes.
Two changes of clothes. Well, it's modest. He knows there were 10 in the caravan, so we'll just ask for two of them.
Two changes of clothes are nothing compared to a kikau kesef.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
But I'm just saying two changes of clothing as if we needed more than one change.
That's like 10 years' salary.
That's a huge amount.
That's a huge amount.
And house, please.
Right. We just got two visitors, so we're going to need a couple $1 million. Okay. You know, like to put them up.
That's like the old Joey Suzu commercial in the 80s. There was a one of the newest forms of advertising. A guy came on and said, you know, this is a beautiful, nice car, and if you come in and buy one this month, we'll give you a free house.
Yeah.
And no, that was an ad, and everybody was laughing. Everybody knew it wasn't true. But they had to put in fine print on the bottom of the screen, he's lying.
Exactly. And if you see Naaman's responses, hey, take 2 talents. Take $2 million. It's all been apportioned. You know, it's all there already. What is Gehazi's sin?
Greed.
Lying.
Yeah, and what else? Lying.
False representation.
False representation. Okay, first he's lied because he wasn't sent by his master, and the whole scenario he came up with, while creative, is not true. And
he's done the strike the rock trick of Moses. He's dishonored God.
Yeah, he's taken glory.
Yes. Well, now he's just accepted the whole point of Elisha refusing. He's just gone against it. He's just tried to unravel everything Elisha was working towards. And so it's the principle of it, not just what he's doing.
He wasn't a faithful servant.
Certainly not, because he's going against Elisha. And if you're believing that Elisha is put in his place by God, he's going against God here. And it is a very big deal because he's potentially jeopardizing the whole point. Although Naaman seems to, you know, it doesn't bother him directly. But who knows what he really thinks about it.
He's probably seeing some short-term gain. You know, we could probably
right.
use this money. We'll enhance what our, you know, we have some really important short-term goals
right.
that we need to accomplish as
like our prophets. Initial... Our official answer was no, but
right.
but hey, you know, maybe you could just give a little bit on the side.
We have some very serious things on our agenda, charity wise,
right.
and blah blah blah. But like, they just weren't. He just wasn't seeing the bigger picture than Elisha was.
And so,
but he doesn't know that Elijah didn't send him after Gehazi. He doesn't really know. Not numb and does not know.
No, of course not. That's the whole deception in it. And we don't know Naaman's ultimate response then. But we just know that when Gehazi gets home, Elisha says, where have you been? And he says, me? Huh? Nowhere. And he says, wasn't my heart with you when the man turned on his chariot towards you? And did you make this an opportunity to take money and clothes? And you really need all these, you know, olive groves and all the rest. He basically says, is this so important? Like, this was not the time. It's not that those things are bad. Material goods are fine and they're useful. But this was not the time for it. And you completely messed up the situation. And so the famous punishment in verse 27.
Leprosy.
The leprosy of Naaman will go on you and your descendants. And so... So Naaman, sorry, not Naaman, Gehazi leaves his presence, Metzora Kashaleg. He leaves leprous as snow. Notice he leaves his presence. It says before, one of the ways to say you're a servant is you stand before them. So you leave your presence, you're fired. He's fired, and he has a divine punishment put on him. If you look at all the other stories where God gives leprosy, it's usually because they challenged the divine authority that had been put in place. For instance, Miriam instigates a thing against Moses because he married a Cushite wife. And Aaron gets pulled in too, but it starts with Miriam, and Miriam gets the main punishment. And she's leprous for a week.
And as it said, I think that she perhaps did not trust in God as much as the prophet trusted in God.
Clearly, he didn't, or he was more concerned with what he could get out of the situation than what the message to the other person would be. And so he was really seeing things only on a human level, like, hey, this was great stuff he offered, why not take it? And I go back to my first question, why did the Haftarah start at the end of chapter 4?
The tie-in with the message.
What's the tie-in with the story on the bread?
God supplies good things in abundance, but he can also supply punishment in abundance.
Okay. Specific to Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, although his name isn't mentioned in the preceding story, it's the servant that has doubt. He says, can we really feed 100 people with these 20 loaves? And so you see, when people speak in the Bible, it's a way to see their character. So you see that Gehazi already has this problem of doubting God's ability and doubting the word that God has given the prophet. So you could see his sin multi-layered. One is going against the authority that God has put in place. The other is just doubting God in general, not having the faith. And so this punishment makes sense. Like, this has been a trend. And remember, Gehazi, he should have been the one who would be the disciple and take over for Elisha, just as Elisha took over for Eliyahu. But he's basically cut himself off from that option because he has lost the faith. He doesn't see things with God's eyes, just his own. And we're basically out of time with that. I did want to share one other interesting note.
As you go for that note, just a dumb question. What was the word you said was in the story that was only there?
Betziklon.
Betziklon.
From Ugaritit. Meaning, I share that Betziklon is a type of grain, roughly a synonym of shibboleth, but it could also be used as a dry measurement, in the same way Omer is both the grain and the dry measurement.
Not a knapsack,
right. So the gifts, the first fruits brought were both two descriptions of grain type of things. Some were in loaves and some
Can
something
I
else.
Just make an observation.
Sure.
It makes me think of the story of Ananias and Sapphira as well.
Okay.
Also misrepresentation.
Right.
And they played with their lives.
Yeah. And that is a good point. He brought up Ananias and Sapphira and how misrepresenting God to other people has very serious ramifications. And Moses and Aaron being excluded, that was brought up, hitting the rock, not portraying God the way you want to be portrayed to the people. So it has very serious repercussions. One more interesting note, this is not directly connected to this story, but to leprosy. It's very interesting. I was reading Kugel's book, and he mentioned that ancient Egyptian historians have recorded about the, you've heard of the Hyksos people, that they came and invaded Egypt and took it over for a while. They were, some people call them Hyksos, some people call them Syrians, whatever they were, some foreigners. And the reason that Egyptian historians give for their expulsion is that they were leprous, or apparently that's one of the reasons. And later on, historians started associating Jews with those Hyksos people, although modern scholarship certainly doesn't do that at all. But it's interesting, I'm going to quote for you, ancient historians now claim that the reason for their expulsion was that they were afflicted with leprosy or some other uncleanness. And we don't know exactly when that shows up, but Manetho, which is early 3rd century BC, and Lysimachus, which is 2nd to 1st century BC, are Greek writers who mention this tradition of the Jews being kicked out of Egypt because they were unclean, / leprous. And later writers also use this. It became a racial slur for Jews. And so, Diodorus.
Would this have anything to do with the fact that the Egyptians were darker skinned and this is a racial prejudice?
Well, I don't think the Egyptians were darker skinned of the time. They're actually quite light.
But if you look in the, like the cave, I mean in the tomb paintings, you've got the darker Egyptians.
Well, you've got both. And there were the two kingdoms, so the southern part would be darker. Field workers are darker, but you have the same Song of Solomon. People who work in the field get darker. But sure, there can be racial prejudices all through history. And certainly there is anti-Semitism. I want to read Diodorus. He's called Diodorus. In English we say Diodorus Siculus. He was 60 to 30 B.C., so just before Jesus' time. He wrote a history of the world, called the Bibliotheca Historica, and I'm going to quote for you in English from what he says. The ancestors of the Jews had been driven out of all Egypt as men who were impious and detested by the gods. For, by way of purging the country, all persons who had white or leprous marks on their bodies had been assembled and driven across the border as being under a curse. The refugees then occupied the territory around Jerusalem, and having organized the nation of the Jews, made their hatred of mankind into a tradition, and on this account introduced utterly outlandish laws, not to break bread with any other race, nor to show them any goodwill at all.
When is this written?
60 to 30 BC is when Diodorus Siculus.
Just after Pompey took over the land here.
So, there is floating around in the Greco-Roman world this idea of expulsion of the lepers. That the Jews are kicked out of Egypt because they were leprous. And in fact, Josephus has to counter this accusation when he writes against Appian. And even Jubilees may be hinting at it. Exodus 1:12. It mentions the men of Egypt regarded the sons of Israel as defiled. And so maybe defiled is hinting at this idea that they were lepers. And, of course, the only connection you can make between leprosy and the Exodus in the Bible is what? Moses' sign. He gives three signs. One of them is put your hand in your bosom, pull it out, and it'll be leprous, right? And so it's interesting that to negate this basically racial slur going around, people translating the Bible are trying to downplay this aspect, so that there's no, you can't possibly make any connection, even though it's not directly connected anyway. But because of that, when they translated the Bible into Greek, guess what they left out? If you look at Exodus 4:6.
And we will.
His hand had become like snow. So they left out that word leprosy. Leprous. And if you contrast that, if you look in Numbers 12, I think around verse 11, where it says Miriam in her punishment, it does say in the Greek, leprosa. She became leprous white as snow. So here there's a conscious, they're not using that word they could have used, and they're saying white as snow.
Wait, what's the point? Why are they leaving it out?
Because they don't want any connection to leprosy and the Exodus. Because of what these other anti-Semitic pagan historians are saying. The rumors going around in the literature are that Israel was kicked out of Egypt because of lepers, not because, you know, they were redeemed or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's kind of to make sure that there's no foothold in the text that they could use against it.
Right.
Kind
Exodus 4.6.
Exodus 4.6.
Got it.
Also, Ezekiel, the tragedian.
So when the Septuagint is being written, you're saying?
Right.
They're trying to stay away from that.
Right, and several other writers in that time.
Yeah, okay.
And the Targum Onkelos is, it just mentions white as snow, but white can also be used in the context of leprosy, so it's a little more ambiguous.
Yeah.
And Jewish, Josephus, as he wrote Jewish Antiquities, He also says Moses' hand was white of a color resembling chalk. It doesn't mention leprosy. And I just mention all that as an aside. It has to do with our parasha. But also, if you remember Gary's Bible study from last year, talking about one of the concepts of Messiah was that he was afflicted by God. And the ultimate affliction is leprosy. And so you actually have this tradition that the Messiah was going to be a leper. And I thought it was interesting to reverse the racial slur that's going around at the same time that all those Jews were just kicked out because they were all lepers. Like, the Messiah actually identifies with the wrong, I mean, it's not true, but the worst it could be, the most shameful, he goes there and redeems them. Like, he's willing to go that far and be the leper Messiah. So I just thought that was an interesting connection to pass on.
11 months ago, I squirted the ant poison and the wind blew it into my face. I had it turn out with a massive skin reaction and nearly died even and couldn't breathe.
Wow.
And I've been suffering ever since, but many months ago, I read this story and I've been seeing my prayer. And I can't believe I managed to get that good. That I believe that I'm going to go home healed. I'm not going to have all this red rash, itchy, burning. And I can't believe this is your
Bible
study today. And while I'm sitting, I'm saying, Lord, I can't believe this. Must I go to the Jordan now?
Yes.
Can somebody
tell me? Well, if God says it, you better do it.
How can I
go? I don't know, but it doesn't hurt.
Nobody's close.
I don't know, but may you be healed regardless of what you do or where you go.
And it's his faith.
It's his faith. It definitely was his faith.
He believed it. And what Jesus said, your faith has made you whole.
That's true. Faith makes you whole.
For me,
Okay.
You should do that.
Well, let's say it perfect.
Become Jewish.
Go ahead, Danny. What's your name?
I'm David, and this is my group. They walk in, there's a trail from Nazareth to Capernaum tomorrow.
Okay.
She's over 5 days.
Well, and Danny, would you pray for David?
I can't do that because of my rash. I can't carry food into the big rain. My son's leaving.
Okay.
But I would like to be cured.
All right. Well, we'll pray, and then we need to head down because the service is starting.
Lord, thank you for today. We thank you for this powerful message of healing and faith and of agreement. We agree together that you are a God of the universe, and we want to believe together with David that you are powerful enough to do all things in you, and Lord. In your timing and in your way, Lord, like Elisha, we don't have some sort of magical solution to sort of suggest some magic potion or a dip or jump or do a somersault. God, you do it in your way, and we will have faith together, Lord, that it will happen in your timing.